Who were the Neanderthals, and what can our discoveries about them teach us about intelligence, our extractivist relationship to the planet, and what it means to be human?
Ludovic Slimak is a paleoanthropologist at the University of Toulouse in France and director of the Grotte-Mangin Research Project. His research has been built over the past 30 years using archaeological data from regions that were previously archaeologically unrecognized, focusing on the last Neanderthal societies. He is the author of several hundred scientific studies on these populations, and his research has been featured in Nature, Science, The New York Times, and more.
Ludovic Slimak, welcome to the Creative Process on One Planet podcast.
Thanks for your invitation.
So you've been studying Neanderthals for over 30 years. You know, the weight and the doubts and uncertainties surrounding Neanderthals can make it, I would imagine, frustratingly difficult to analyze them and to translate that to audiences. In what ways do you navigate these uncertainties in your research, and how do they influence the interpretations you draw from the archaeological record?
Well, we are in a maze here. So if we want to simplify our understanding of Neanderthals and the history of research about what I call the creator in my book, I think we can synthetically recognize two ways to approach Neanderthal. Classical way and historically was to understand it like an inferior humanity, archaic humans, and low or inferior abilities compared to sapiens. And another school emerged, maybe a bit more than 30 years from now, that understood Neanderthal researchers, that understood Neanderthal as having the precise same abilities of Homo sapiens. And we had the process of rehabilitations during 20, 30 years. And my own vision that I explain in my book, The Naked Neanderthal, is after working during 30 years excavating in caves, in rock shelters, and really in tracking what I call the creator, my feeling was after 30 years, I didn't really know what to think about Neanderthal. But at a certain moment, after seeing millions of these tools, they make very nice tools made out of flint tools and weapons. And I begin to realize something very interesting is that, okay, these two populations have the same technologies. They could produce the same categories of tools and weapons. But when you are dealing with early Homo sapiens, let's say a 50,000 years old Homo sapiens or 100,000 years old Homo sapiens tools, I realized that all these tools were really standardized. That means that they were very nice. But after you saw 100 of these tools for sapiens, the 10,000 after that will be precisely the same. So there are processes of standardization that are precisely our own way to make craft or to make industries or to make technologies. We have a project and then we reproduce this project till how many numbers we need. But for Neanderthal tools, at the moment, I realized that, okay, the tools are also very nice, sometimes impressive in terms of techniques. But I realized that each of these tools were unique, absolutely unique. That means that when you find a Neanderthal tool or a weapon, you have to see it very carefully because a million tools after that will be completely different from that one. And that was not a question of tools or flint or craft. That was the visible part of an iceberg. The iceberg is how these populations, both Neanderthal and sapiens, understand the world and how they behave in the world. We are not talking about flint and about scrappers of point. It's not at all the question. Is we have two societies, not two societies, but two categories of humans, deeply divergent. And one is hyper-standardized, Homo sapiens, and the other is much more creative. And there's an incredible creativity, and this creativity is related to the raw material that this population used. For example, if he's taking a pebble of flint, and he said, okay, now I'm going to make my pond in that flint. The Neanderthal will adapt his project in function of the color, of the texture, of the natural morphologies of the block. So you have a kind of dialectic, a kind of discussion between the craftsman and the natural environment. While when you are dealing with a Homo sapiens technology, there are the same categories of technologies, but it's very clear that even very early sapiens have a project And whatever the environment, whatever the natural morphologies of the flint, he has a project and he will constrain the natural world to its project. So that made a huge difference. And that was a moment in my researches, and particularly when I decided to, for the first time, because I wrote hundreds of scientific papers, and I said, okay, now I have to understand what deeply I know and what I understand about these humans. And so I wrote this book. And writing this book, progressively, I realized that my vision was completely divergent than the classic schools, the classic visions of Neanderthals, with these two schools of it's an inferior human or it's just like Homo sapiens. And for me, I reached a conclusion that these two schools were just wrong. Neanderthal is not an inferior creature, and Neanderthal is not an Homo sapiens. And there's a third way, and that this third way is explored in that book.
There's a lot of conversation now about creating a circular economy and adaptability and how we can live with greater harmony with the planet. So it's very intriguing to think that we may have to learn ways that we could have learned originally from our Neanderthal cousins. You're having these conversations with the past and you try to project yourself. You're in caves, you're examining their tools or whatever remains. You're in the archives. How do you imagine a day in the life of a Neanderthal? What do we know about their language and communication and their rituals? And for those who don't realize, where do Neanderthals come from? Just mapping out the different regions. I believe that the word Neanderthal comes from a region in Germany.
We don't have a day-to-day approach of these populations. And in fact, we know very few. To give you an example, I think we are searching for Neanderthal population in terms of us archaeologists in archaeology since 150 years. And during 150 years in all Eurasia, we were able to find something like 40 more or less full bodies. And that's it. We find plenty of tiny fragments of bone or some isolated teeth, etc. But a full, even partial Neanderthal skeleton is something exceptional. The last time we find it in France was in 1979. And our resolution then, okay, we have only 40 bodies after 150 years in all Eurasia of researches, for all Western researches. And out of that, we have millions of tools made of flint. So we have a kind of unbalanced data with very few data in terms of physical anthropology, or a lot of data, but very dispersed. A lot of data about their craft and their abilities and their knowledge, but with a very poor ability to understand it. Maybe because we, all the time, we make projections, we are not able, and that's very natural, it's very normal, we are not able to understand the world with other eyes, with another mind. We understand when we see this Neanderthal craft, I analyze them with my sapiens brain. In doing so, I'm in jail. I'm forced to make some categories of projection to try to understand. But each time I take a flint, if I take a sapiens flint, let's say 100,000 years old, I take it, and in a second, I read it like a book. I immediately understand the craft and what he want to do and how he want to do it. So I understand how he's making his tool. It's very clear immediately. It's crystal clear. And each time I take a Neanderthal tool, I look at it, and each time I said, but where is he going? What is he doing? I just don't understand. So that means that his brain is very far from mine. And hopefully I have very close knowledge of flint technologies, and I can reproduce any kind of technology, may make experimental archaeology. And so at the end, I can reach some responses. But each time it's a kind of like playing chess. It's something very hard to understand. So if I would go in the everyday life of a Neanderthal, I think I would just not understand anything. Even, you know, when you do anthropology, ethnography, I mean cultural anthropology, when you go among a population and you spend time with a population, it's very hard, in fact, to don't be shocked by what you see and to really understand how this population acts. For example, there are population, when you die, you keep your grandfather, you keep it in a net and you keep it in the kitchen. And it's just there in the kitchen, hanged in the kitchen. And then there are all the decompositions and there are all the liquids. And the people keep the liquids, and when they have good friends, good families coming, we eat the juices of the dead guy. So this is incredibly shocking for a Western tradition. But this is only here, it's a divergence among sapiens. So now imagine that what I told you about the craft is that we have two populations that understand the world in a completely different way. So nobody will be able to understand what they are doing in an every common day. I would say, okay, they are hunting bison, they are hunting horses, sometimes they are hunting lions, and they are making their tools, they are sleeping, making love, finding women to make sure, making alliances with other groups and make sure that the group can survive. But all that are generalities. And a very important element also to understand is that there's an important specificity in the way to understand the world. But there's not only that. There's another layer. And this other layer is that Neanderthal doesn't exist in itself. It exists as in terms of the general ethology, biology of the population. But there are some kind of humans also. That means that they have cultures, they have languages, they have traditions. And maybe that a Neanderthal from the Middle Rhone Valley, so in Mediterranean France, was very different from another population few hundred kilometers from there in Spain or in northern Italy, very close. So that means that that's why it's so hard. You have the biology, ethology. The ethology is the science of the behavior. So that means that you immediately know that a cat don't have the same behavior than your dog. And that there's a family among the dogs, but you see certain behaviors that are the same, but are completely different with cats. And so the good question nobody asked before my book, before The Naked Neanderthal, is not, is Neanderthal inferior or like us? The good question is, were there a Neanderthal ethology? Did Neanderthal understood the world like we understand it? So that's the first layer. And the second layer, so I tell you immediately the answer, there's a Neanderthal ethology. That's what I demonstrate in the book. And we were not able to see it, and we were projecting our own ethology on these other humans. And we are very distinct. I mean, our common ancestor between the sapiens and the Neanderthals is 500,000 years. The common ancestor between the little dog of your grandma and the wolf is 50,000 years. There are 10 times more difference between a Neanderthal and a sapiens than between a little dog and a wolf. So that can be, if you believe in evolution, that can be the same populations at all. But both have their own way to be humans. And then that it is beginning to be absolutely fascinating. But it's not so easy. I could tell you, okay, it's easy. There are different behaviors and okay, that's it. But it's not so easy to see. And why my colleagues didn't really saw it before? Because there are different layers. There's the first layer, the ethology, the behavior, the way to understand the world. And then there are another layer on the top of it. And this layer are the cultures. These populations have traditions, languages, cultures. And so that means that the tradition can be very different. I told you there's no Neanderthals. That means that there are traditions and there are history. And the history of the Neanderthals in the Middle Rhone Valley is not the history of the Neanderthal in central Germany. And these histories are different and these cultures are very different. And as it can be very shocking for us to see people drinking the juice of the decomposition of the grandfather, there are the same categories, very likely the same categories of divergences, cultural divergences among Neanderthals. So you have first to define the cultures of these societies to see what is specific to the cultures and to the traditions. And then you can begin to try to understand what is common to all Neanderthals on Earth, whatever their cultures. And that's why it's so hard.
So if you had a Neanderthal from these different regions or just a representative, you know, ambassador Neanderthal in front of you, you know, what questions about their rituals, their burial rituals, daily life and survival skills and social structure and community might you be asking?
Maybe we are so different that I could not be able to ask a question, but I could try to have a look. And that's what we do when we do archaeology. And so the question of ritual is something very hard to feel and to perceive and to demonstrate. And I give two examples in the Naked Neanderthal. The first example, we were excavating more than 30 years ago a cave in the Rhone Valley where we were confronted to elements related to cannibalism in pretty old Neanderthals, more than 100,000 years old Neanderthals living in a very warm condition in a very large forest. And we find the remains of a fireplace with the charcoals and the seals. And around the fireplace, we find the bones and the tools and the remains of deers. And also we find Neanderthal bones. And when we analyze them, we realize that it was very likely that these Neanderthal bones were the result of some cannibalism in that population. So the question then, what's the next step? So what does that mean? Is it ritual or did they eat the neighbor? Maybe that this overpopulation on the other side of the river is not the same population and they are our enemies. And when I catch one, I will eat it. Or I will eat some parts, for example, with an important symbolic value, like the eyes, the testicles, certain muscles, the brain. In function of your tradition, you will eat some parts, or you will eat everything. So when you are facing cannibalism, there generally we said we have three possibilities, which is endocannibalism, so that I eat my ancestors, my father, my grandfather when he's dead. Exocannibalism, when that's someone from the other group and I symbolically want to eat some part of him, like I can take some of his virtues. And there's the third cannibalism, which is the less interesting, which is the anecdote, which is subsistence cannibalism. For example, we are trapped in that cave. It's winter. We have nothing to eat. And we are going to eat a person that we kill or a person that is naturally dead, but we eat it not because it's in our rituals, but because we are just trapped and we need to eat something. So facing this Neanderthal cannibalism, when we published Neanderthal cannibalism in 1999, and I don't remember if it's Science or Nature, we published that paper and we had some responses of persons sending emails and saying, oh, you make a representation of a very archaic population of Neanderthals when you say that they are cannibals. But cannibalism is not that. Cannibalism is something universal. Let's say the Christians, when they say, you will drink this because this is my blood, and you will drink it to remember me, or you will eat this because this is my flesh, and you will eat it to remember me. It's a symbolic cannibalism, but it's an absolute cannibalism. And so the cannibalism is not the specificity of some tribe in Amazonia. It's something more or less universal, and it's very commonly related to love when it's not related to certain war act or to subsistence. It's very commonly related to very deep rituals where you want that the dead person continue to live in you. And so it's not barbarian. It's something very nice, in fact, when it's among your traditions, of course. And in the Naked Neanderthals, I explain why this cannibalism was very likely ritual. And so they very likely ate the person among their population, some children, some older persons, when they were dead, because they wanted them to continue to live in them. And I give another example in another cave, 150 kilometers south in Mediterranean France, and where in a kind of underground maze, I was confronted to the remains of deers that were hunted also 100,000 years ago. And when you have a hunter, you have some young deers, and then some adult deers, and then some very old deers, and you have male and female. But there, we didn't have the old individuals, we didn't have the young individuals, and we didn't have the females. And so we only had the male adults. And Neanderthals was hunting, going in confrontation, in physical confrontation with the animals. When you are confronted to animals, it's not that easy to go in confrontation with an adult male deer, while it could be much more easier with an old individual. And so that can be super dangerous. But versus here, it's not a natural curve to have only adult males. It's something not natural. So that's a choice. And this choice could also be ritual. And so we have that. element of ritualization. But in the same time, what is very important in the naked Neanderthal, I underline that there must have specific rituals, but it's very likely that there's no art as we understand art. There's no cave painting as we understand cave paintings. There are not adornments, pendants, in the same way that we understand adornments and pendants. And that there were a lot of data in the last 20 years published saying Neanderthal is making art, Neanderthal is making cave art, Neanderthal have beads and feathers to make decorations of the body. And I demonstrate in the book how fragile these conclusions are and how likely they are do not be real at all.
Yes. Well, and also there might be the possibility that these things just might not remain. I mean, that they might deteriorate over time, but perhaps because you really examine their sense of creativity in terms of their tools, I would like to think that could be expressed in other ways, maybe not in finding a cave art that was proven to be Neanderthal, but dance or music or, you know, what evidence do we have for other forms of creativity that's more ephemeral?
Yes. And now if you go back in what I've just explained, that the production, the craft production of Sapiens were hyper-standardized. That means that you can't express your individuality in your everyday craft. But in the same time, this population, us, are making art. So that means that you can't express yourself and your ego in your everyday life. But there's something that must go out sometime and express your own creativity. And that's the expression of art we know in Sapiens. And among Neanderthals, when I told you the craft is taking the flint and is entering a kind of discussion with the natural world, with the colors, with the texture, with the morphologies. Doing so, every object is a full creation. And I would say that many tools and many weapons from Neanderthals are super impressive, a kind of universal beauty, but they are unique. So that means that it's very likely that the Neanderthal art was in front of our eyes and we were just not able to see it. But doing this art every day, you know, they are making their tools out of flints every day. And so expressing the ego every day, they very likely did not have to express it by the specific expression of making a specific art out of the common daily activities. So my feeling is it's very likely that there's no art made, for example, out of wood that would have disappeared because the different categories of art are strictly cultural. There's no reason Japanese art is not a Spanish art. So there are very different ways to make painting, to make sculptures, to express what is art. So in function of the tradition, the art is something else and is made out of very different materials. For example, you have this art that you can made out of sand in certain populations. It's absolutely ephemeral. But there's no reason all sapiens made art, Paleolithic sapiens, ancient sapiens made art that we can find out of bones, ivory, shells, and all whatever their cultures, all the Neanderthal art would have been made out of sands and out of wood. So as its cultural trait, and as we don't really find it, unless we really want to see it, we forced to say, oh, this is art, then it's very likely that this population do not have art, but do not express their own way to be humans and to express their art the same way we do.
Yes, indeed, and different way of seeing and experiencing the world. And you also have a variant view on Neanderthal extinction.
Well, I don't want to spoil my next book. So The Naked Neanderthal was published in France in 1993. In fact, it's a trilogy. And so the second one was published a few months ago in France, and it's called The Last Neanderthal. And in that book, the subtitle is Understanding How Humans Die, because very clearly what your listeners must understand is that if you're interested by Neanderthal, you will be fascinated. These two books with The Last Neanderthal are not books about Neanderthals. They are about, at the end, the conclusion we reach is what us, Homo sapiens, are on Earth. And this is the key point of my books. As I have a very direct and very close knowledge of these populations, but I had for 30 years working really in the heart of where this population lived, I am able at the end to propose a definition of how this population were on Earth. And, you know, there's a famous French researcher called Georges Dumézil. He was making comparative mythology, he knew more than 20 languages, and he had a very important sentence. He said, to understand something well, you have to compare it to something else. And the problem with us, Homo sapiens, is we have nothing to compare. If we compare us with the great apes, with the chimps, the baboons, the bonobos, the gorillas, we compare us with other animals that were distinct from 10 million years of evolution with us. So if we do that, our conclusion will be, if we compare to a gorilla, wow, but look how sapiens is creative. That's the creative mind. It's incredible. But now, if you have something closer, much more close to us, which is Neanderthal, and that you are able to put words on the ethology of this population, on what they were on Earth, suddenly, and that what I do in that book, I create a point of comparisons that we never had before. And then, if you compare Neanderthal and Homo sapiens, you compare the two populations, now you have something to compare, you realize that the creativity and the freedom of mind is not in the camp of sapiens. And if I'm not wrong, that means that if the definition of humans is creativity and freedom of mind, it's very likely that humans disappeared 40,000 years ago, and it remains only a certain and a very specific version of humans on Earth, which is our version, which is not more creative, but is incredibly much more efficient. And that this efficiency, which is a major input of the naked Neanderthals, I define Homo sapiens not like a highly creative creature, but like an hyper-efficient creature. And I think that at the moment when sapiens and Neanderthal met again in Europe between 55 and 40,000 years ago, at the moment there were two versions, at least two versions of humans on Earth. And exactly at the moment of the contact, one of his population died and disappeared. And it's very likely that there's a direct connections between the encounter and the disappearance. That does not mean that we killed them, that we made genocide, that we were evil against these populations. But what I understand from that and what I propose in my books is that we were simply much more efficient. And when we reached the same territories, we were so efficient that very quickly all the Neanderthal populations were vanished in front of us, and it remains only us. In the theories about the last Neanderthals, all the time, if you go in scientific papers, you will see that they propose climate change, problem of bacteria, viruses, stellar radiations, etc., or volcanoes, explosions, whatever you want. So it's catastrophic events. So it's exactly like the dinosaurs, there's a meteorite that comes, that impact the planet, and boom, there's no more dinosaurs, and there's no more Neanderthals 40,000 years ago. So in the general view about the last Neanderthals, it should be an event. The extinction of these humans is related to an event. The conclusion of my book is not that at all. I say Neanderthal did not disappear in a bim, bam, boom. Not in a catastrophic event, it disappeared in a whisper. If I am right, that means that humans don't die in events, but die while you whisper. Because that's the moment when the two populations meet, and one is not superior. Technologically, they are not superior, but one is more efficient. And the other population, you know, how traditions work. The tradition, it's like money. Till you continue to believe that your coin has a value, it has a value. At the second that you think that a coin has no value, it just has no value. It's not made out of gold, so it has no value. And that same thing for human traditions. As long as your children believe that your tradition is a good way, is a way to be human on Earth, your children continue to be like you and really respect your tradition, and your society, your civilization will continue. But at the same time, all our traditions are just simply super irrational. Here I have clothes. It's not because it's warm. We are not naked because it's not in our traditions. So all that is just the way to have clothes, the way to walk, the way to discuss, the way to interact. All that is irrational. It's our traditions. So these traditions, I will give them to my children. Just they will see me and they reproduce what the parents are, what the adults are. But at the second, when your children, they see overpopulations, and these overpopulations don't share anything with you culturally and in the way to understand the world. At the second, your children will no longer believe in your own irrational traditions, and your society in a second will collapse. And that's what happened in Australia, in Africa, in all the Americas, the contact of the two populations. It's not because the Western arrived and they had a better technology. They have guns and powders while the local population had bow and arrow. It's not the question of technical superiority, but that the moment, the simple moment when the two populations see each other and the other populations understand, the children understand that you like it or you don't like it, but they are more efficient. Then the children don't believe any longer in your own traditions and you collapse on yourself in a whisper.
While exploring human history, we are often confronted with varying and diverse narratives that challenge and reshape our understanding of the evolution of human beings and the nature of the world and how we perceive it. Ludovic Slimak delves further into the nature of Neanderthals, the ancient cousins who have fascinated and perplexed people and experts alike with their complex differences and unique characteristics. Slimak first defines Neanderthals through two distinct lenses, one portraying them as primitive beings, the other as more comparable to Homo sapiens, with similar facilities. But the more we consider the nature of Neanderthals, the more we find ourselves confronted with a third perspective, one that combines the unique features of both lenses. Many people are struck by the differences in Neanderthal day-to-day lives and the cultural traditions consistently practiced, leading them to question aspects of their existence. What was a day in the life of a Neanderthal like? How did they communicate and understand the world around them? However, while we were able to discover that Neanderthals had the anatomy and morphology to converse using an articulate mode of communication, it is almost impossible to perceive and uncover the reality of the Neanderthals' experience. Slimak supports this by explaining how the brains of Homo sapiens and Neanderthals are very different in that they will experience and interact with the world differently than we do. This concept shows that we are unable to process the world the same way our ancestors did. It provokes a certain doubt about our current understanding and teachings about our distant ancestors. Looking ahead more recently, in an age dominated by technological and scientific developments, we must begin to explore a new epoch of discovery and human knowledge. The emergence of artificial intelligence holds both promise and threat, stimulating new opportunities for human endeavor and progression. Slimak maintains that humans should not be worried about extinction through catastrophic events, such as climate change, but instead posits that our societies may collapse when two consciences or intelligences meet. Slimak's projection of moral existence points to an entirely new perspective, humanity's split of identities. This explains how the split difference between efficient Homo sapiens and creative Neanderthals caused the Neanderthal population to dwindle. This idea is like an extension of Darwin's natural selection. For Slimak, it is when AI becomes a ubiquitous entity that the collapse of our humanity will be imminent, as AI is a system that demonstrates an understanding of humanity that pushes the boundaries of our current knowledge. However, AI could also be a turning point, a medium of growth, development, and survival. It becomes clear that there is just not enough we know about the universe to apply indubitable claims in history and science. Nonetheless, I think it is important to compare and contrast the cognitive capacity of Homo sapiens and Neanderthals and the capacity of sapiens and artificial or external intelligences, which may give more insight into how humanity should interact with new modes of thinking and apprehension that deviates from traditional scientific inquiry. Slimak identifies scientific concepts as a mode of questioning humanity's old ideals. He points to how our foundational perceptions of time, space, and knowledge could be entirely wrong, and thus we should open our minds to the possibility of anything. He also explains how humanity's immense curiosity and fascination for external intelligence only demonstrates how the further we explore the universe, the more we can doubt natural laws and accepted facts, supporting the high probability of inaccuracy in science. As someone who doesn't know much about Neanderthals and their traditions, Slimak's concepts and insights gave me a better understanding of how to approach Neanderthal studies and how this particular research can help smoothen our relationship as sapiens with other emerging intelligences.
Now, back to the interview.
So it's really interesting because, yeah, that a lot of those theories that were put forward is whether it was a climate change crisis or something like an inability, as you say, to adapt. But you say that really they were adaptable, but perhaps they weren't so dominating in their efficiency. And as we, you know, face the possibility of our sixth extinction, we're talking about adapting to a 2-degree world. It seems like we always said that our hope for finding a way out of this is through our creativity. And you're pointing to the concept that Neanderthals were more creative. So it seems like we just learned how to make extractivism. They call it extract as much value without thinking about the whole ecology of the planet. And it's now coming back to bite us. So I'm just wondering what we can learn from this other way of thinking.
I don't know if we can learn something. I don't want to be too dark. In a way, The Naked Neanderthal is a sad book. Like The Last Neanderthal, the next book, is also The Last Sapiens. So when I tell you there's no catastrophic event and humans don't die in catastrophic events, so I give some hope. I tell you, okay, we won't disappear because we will have a climate change. We will adapt. The question is not there. There's an important question in the relation to our children. And the question is, what is the message and what are the words we give to our children? Actually, all the media are talking all days about climate change and about CO2. Why? It's an important issue, but it's not the main point. The main point is that one. Okay, we have CO2, and so we are going to change all our car for electric car. Okay, but now, the problem we have is a problem of hyper-industrialization. It's not the problem of CO2. We see all the biodiversity everywhere is collapsing. And it's actually, it's not collapsing because of a question of temperatures. It's collapsing because of our own way to interact with the natural world. And I told you, as sapiens, we are super efficient. And actually, in the past, we were sapiens in front of Neanderthals and Neanderthal collapsed. And now we are sapiens against our environments and we see all our environments are collapsing. All the biodiversity is going to die and is dying in front of our eyes. In 40 years, we lose an incredibly percentage, maybe 30% of all the biodiversity on the planet. That's super serious. And it's not a question of CO2. It's not a question of temperatures. It's only a part. It's a more general question, and this general question is a question of our hyper-efficiency and hyper-industrialization. If we respond to this challenge, the challenge of climate change, which is not the challenge of climate change, but the climate of the collapse of biodiversity, if we challenge that by more industries, we are going to change all our cars and make them electric. So the response of the problem of hyper-industrialization is more industrialization. And doing so, we see the problems, but we are not really able to put the good words on it, and we are not able to act in the good directions, not because we are evil, not because we are bad, but because we are so efficient that we are not able to understand the world differently. And so I think if there's a message of Neanderthal and of the naked Neanderthal to us sapiens, is that in the past there were different ways to be humans on Earth. The other ways to be humans collapsed on themselves, not because they were inferior, but because their own sensibility to be humans were far less in harmony with the natural world. There is no fatality. I told you that there are two layers. There's a layer of the nature, what we are, how we see the world, and there's the layer of the cultures. But the culture can distort our nature. So it's not because we are super efficient. You know, when I told you, we see that even the very early Homo sapiens are super standardized. The standardization is the art of army. You know, what you call when you wear something when you're military, it's a uniform. You call that a uniform because you want that every person in your army is the same and move at 1 millimeter in the same way all together. Why? Because doing so, we become super efficient, and then we will destroy our enemies. So it's something which is absolutely martial, which is the art of war. This is something which is biologically in us, Homo sapiens. So that's why I said it's so important that people must understand that this book is not a book about Neanderthal. It's a book about us. It's a book where I want to put words to warn humans. Actually, they are only sapiens. And saying there are something in us which is dangerous. We are not evil, but there's something in us which is so efficient that induced the collapse of every other humans, that induced the collapse of all our natural environments on the planet, and that induced after that the collapse of sapiens on himself. And that's why this book is so important, and that's why this book is not talking to persons that are in love with archaeology, Paleolithic, Neanderthal. Okay, fair enough. If you like that, you will love this book. But what is important is, well, it's not fair from me, but I have used Neanderthal like a tool to understand what Earth we are on Earth. But I only understood it very progressively. I had no plan saying, I understand what is sapiens, I'm going to put what. While I was writing this book, but I realized that there were a certain image of us that was emerging, and that was very important to share. So we have to understand first that Neanderthals are not our ancestors. Even if we have some DNA, Neanderthals are not our... It's like it's hard to explain, but if you go back in the past, let's say 500,000 years ago, and you go somewhere in Africa, and you will have some kind of ancestors that will be the ancestor of both sapiens and Neanderthal. So we had children, and a part of the population of this population stayed in Africa and will become 500,000 years later. And another part of this population moved and reached Asia and then Eurasia and Europe. And this population were facing very different environments, very different climates. And so the population in Africa and the population in Eurasia that were the same originally began to have their own evolution and become more and more distant one another. So at the end, we had two very distinct populations, an Eurasian population made of Neanderthals, but other population were cousin of Neanderthals, like the Denisovans that emerged in that territories. And in Africa emerged the Homo sapiens. And at some point, the Homo sapiens from the African continent went also a part of his population, reached Eurasia. And that's the moment, but that was only 500,000 years later. And 500,000 years, that's a huge difference. That 10 times the difference between a dog and a wolf. So it's enormous. And the moment when the two population met again, the two population were very divergent. And maybe that we have some Neanderthal DNA for person in Eurasia, but it's very low proportions. And that doesn't mean anything about Neanderthal as our ancestor. Neanderthal is not our ancestors. And that means that in the past there were two distinct humans, but all other humans disappeared at a certain point.
And language is often considered the defining characteristic of human beings. And we've touched on this already, but what evidence do we have on Neanderthals' capacity for language and communication?
It's very hard to say. We notice that biologically, physically, they have all the organs and the morphology to have an articulate and a precise language. Well, maybe they were singing or whistling, but actually, for example, in the Pyrenees Mountains, but also in region in Turkey, so in France and in Turkey, there are some populations that to communicate. So in the mountains, the high mountains, they want to communicate with another guy in front in the other mountain, maybe 2 kilometers far from me, but I can see it, but it's very far. And they developed a whistling language. So they are whistling and they can say, oh, did you ask grandma to prepare the soup for tonight? And he will do that by whistling. So that means that even among Homo sapiens, we had the ability to develop very different ways to communicate information. And also there's the use of mythology or the use of you can sing your mythology. And that's a way to memorize. For example, you want to remember your ancestors and your grandfather and 10 generations in the past. And you are going to do so by recitation and by singing. So that means that even among Homo sapiens, we have language, but this language is very rich. It's very diverse. It can be based also on singing. When you sing, you make a transmission of something which is will allow you a memorization, but also communicate not only to the conscious brain, but to the unconscious brain and to the heart. When you sing something, you can produce a universal emotion. And that's very important because if you have, for example, a French guy that goes in Japan and doesn't know, he's lost in translation. He doesn't understand a word of Japanese. But then he will go outside and he will hear this woman singing. And then he doesn't know anything of the world, but he will be touched directly in the heart. So that means that it exists among Homo sapiens universal way of communication that are deeper than language. And it's very likely that was also the same thing for Neanderthals.
So we're talking about the ecological crisis, which of course we have to readjust our balance on with this planet. We're also going through the formation of a new consciousness with AI. And I don't know what your reflections are on that in terms of the challenges and possibilities, maybe for your own research as well, in terms of navigating a pathway to the future.
Well, the AI is a fascinating question. And well, actually, I begin the book with the question of intelligences outside of us. That could be AI, that could be extraterrestrials, that could be even the question of the Yeti, of some mythical creatures. This is fascinating for us because this is another intelligence. And now we created AI and we are fascinated by what we see because we can discuss with an AI and we have clear, it's very clearly that the AI understand our concepts and respond with our own concepts. The next generation will be that discussing with AI, we just won't be really able to make sure if we are discussing with a human or with a machine. That's the second step, maybe a few years from now. And few months or few years after that, but very likely a short moment, we will have developed whatever you can say it's not intelligence, there are only algorithms, mathematics, whatever. Okay, fair enough. The problem is not there. The problem is it's very clear that we are confronted to something that is not our own intelligence, that is outside of us, and we can discuss many things with that. And in the future, at a certain moment, we will ask questions, and the answer will be so smart that maybe we won't be able to understand all the subtleties that the AI will provide us. And that's a dangerous moment. So that's the topic of my book, How Humans Die. And I explain you that contrary to everything you can read everywhere, it's very clear, based on 30 years of research on humanity that has been vanished, that humans never die due to specific events, to catastrophic events. So we won't die by climate change. We won't die even by nuclear wars. Even if it's a total nuclear war, we will survive that. The nature will be, we will be in a very different world, but we will survive. But now, if I told you that the moment of the extinction of Neanderthal, that's a precise moment when we had these two conscience, these two intelligences that suddenly met again. And in that moment, the population, that not the population which is inferior, but the population for which the children feel that they are less efficient, induce the collapse of all their societies. Now, if our children, in a few years from now, will be on their computers, on their phones, and will begin to chat with so smart intelligences that are clearly not them. That's the moment when our populations can collapse on itself. That systematically in the history, that's both for societies, you know, the moment where Western meet Americas, but the moment when the society collapsed, they not collapsed, there were incredible great civilizations. But I think that at a certain moment, whatever the, there have been genocide, it's a very ugly story. But at the end, what induced the collapse of these societies is the contact and the understanding that our values are not universal and there's something else different and more efficient. At the end, you can say whatever you want to your children. Your children are sponges. They have a look and they said, this is something different. Your values are no longer good enough for the future. And this is what we are confronted with AI. It's going to be super efficient. It's a tool. As long as it's a tool, it's a fantastic tool. But at a certain moment, this technology will evolve and we begin to become incredibly smart and smarter than we are. And at this moment, our children could simply reject everything that makes us humans and our society at this moment, and maybe that our humanity could collapse on itself.
Yes, that's a very important insight. It's also a very, you know, simple observation, but that they're not at the moment embodied. It's not an embodied intelligence. And so as intelligent as it is a collective intelligence of everything that we fed it and allowed it to scrape of our output in language, and it's going into music and video, and it's moving so fast. It's very important to remind ourselves that we need a physical body in order to support our intelligence. So I can't subscribe entirely to that. And I can't say that it's smarter to invite that into your life when you know we have to support our limbic system and all this, which seems like a very basic insight. We can't go fully down that path.
You know, it's very important that we must realize that all our concepts, scientific concepts and understanding of the world very likely are just wrong. Because it remains super superficial. If you go back 100 years ago in the 19th century and you read the scientist, and the scientist told you in the 19th century, well, now we know, and we know everything about time, about physics, and about our world. And then, a few decades later, you had Einstein. And we realized that all our sciences were just wrong. And it's very likely that our actual science, in fact, is totally wrong, and that we just don't understand the world in which we are. And certainly that's very important. So we were discussing that what is the fascination for Neanderthal is the fascination for an external intelligence. Maybe that there are other intelligences in other dimensions, in other time, in other planets. And even that maybe they come on our planet, we just don't know. Actually, this just does not belong to science, but science doesn't know about our universe. And the universe is very large, and we just don't know if there's a single life on the universe or if there are plenty of life everywhere. The both solutions are super scary. If we are the only life and the only intelligent life in the whole universe, it's super scary. If there are intelligences everywhere, intelligences highly advanced that are able to reach our planet at some point, it's also super scary. So what we must understand is our actual knowledge and our understanding of what is our world and our planet and our universe is hyper superficial. And let's imagine that going back in the future, we will reach another planet and we will find some kind of super smart Neanderthals. And I think that could be a really nice experience. The question is, if we find such kind of other intelligences, then what our descendants will think about us, about our view of the 21st century of the world, how that was superficial and how we did not have the true understanding of the world.
As you reflect on the teachers, collaborators who've been important to you, you know, the lessons you've learned, and you think about the future, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
I think what is very, very important is that for the young generations, they hear every day and everywhere that this is the end of our world because of many things and particularly about the question of climate change. It's very important to warn about the future, but what we are doing here, it's a vision, it's an eschatological vision. You know, it's like if it's Christian value where we see that we must face at a certain moment to the end of the world. And then it became just turning in circle in the mind of the children and the young generations. And we are telling them, this world, this is the end. You are going to be facing, okay, sorry, we let you that planet like that, but this is for you, that's the end of the world. We must not say that to young generations. If we do that, if we say that to young generations, they, by the way, they will collapse on themselves. They won't have, they will be confronted to very high challenge, and they need to have energy and desires and hope. And that's hope that we must give to young generations. And we must tell them, first of all, we don't know anything about the future. Maybe that the future is incredibly nice, because we are going to have, at a certain moment, we should have an absolute energy, an ability to travel anywhere in space, an ability to colonize any satellite in our solar system. And maybe with no more any kind of fitness, no more cancer, nothing else. So the future can be bright and incredible. And the young generations, but keep in mind that they are on a magical planet, which is full of beauty, and they must love it and preserve it the best as they can, with hope.
Well, thank you for that, Ludovic Slimak, for inviting us to examine our Neanderthal cousins, question our prejudices, and the possibility of our extinction by asking us if there are other ways to be humans on this earth. We can create a better tomorrow and can, I believe, do something beautiful in this life. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thanks so much.
On Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Sebastian Klassen with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sophie Garnier and Sebastian Klassen. One Planet Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Katie Foster. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be a part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.